Thank you, Randy. That's the most recent introduction I've ever had. Good to be here today. I want to thank the committee for inviting us up. It's a real privilege to be here. We've been here three years ago and really enjoyed the fellowship. You guys have really got it going down here, I know that. Not all conferences are this loving and enthusiastic that I've been to. This one's been great, and I appreciate it very much. I was telling somebody a while ago, when they asked me why I didn't button this coat, I said, I can't button this coat. My wife and I went off on a cruise in January, and we've gone all January to get out of the cold up there, and went out here to Jacksonville, went out up there. And we went on the cruise as passengers, and we came off as cargo. It can happen, you know. But I'm glad to be here this morning. My sponsor's name was Franklin Williams from Olive Branch, Mississippi. And some of y'all knew him. He's a tremendous fellow. I asked him one time about gratitude and gratefulness. It's two different words, and he explained them to me. He said, Joe, when you're grateful for things received. And when you have gratitude, that means you return back to that which you're grateful for. And so today, when I go to sometimes I go to those meetings and they want to talk about gratitude, I don't know what to say to them. Because I'm as grateful as I know how to be, you know, and I can't tell them how grateful I am. I tell them how thankful I am, because I'm very thankful here this morning. Very thankful that I'm sober today by God's grace. And Phyllis and I were talking this morning about how great everything is in our life today. Excuse me. Hadn't always been that way. When I talk about them old timers in AA, like my friend Franklin, I get a little choked up. Because he told me one time, I went over to see him on his deathbed, and I knew he was going to die, and he did too. And he looked at me and said, Joe, I want you to promise me something. I said, what's that, Franklin? He said, you leave Alcoholics Anonymous exactly the way you found it. Don't change nothing. I said, yes, sir, I'll not do that. And I tried not to do that. And I tried to live the way he's taught me to live. He also taught me how to die. And he said, and I said, I'm going to miss you. And he said, I'm going to miss you too. He said, but don't worry about it. If I die, I'll go over there and be with Bill and Bob. And if I don't, I'll get to stay here with you and George. Either way, it's a win-win deal. And I said, I can do that. I can do that. Yeah, that's a good deal. I can do that. And one time old Franklin told me, he said, Joseph, I think that everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous ought to read one of these little pamphlets. I was at the club there the other day, and Don made a magnificent talk and really talked some real good AA. And I knew some good AA was going on in that clubhouse over there because Don and Joe and these people were there. And I noticed this in the little literature rack there. And it tells me here on this third page, and Bill Wilson wrote this, by the way. I didn't. And it said right up here, it said sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. That's the only reason to have an AA group, the practice and teaching of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I see that going on here, and I'm very, very thankful for that. That's been a message we've been trying to carry for a long time. But to get back to me, and on page 18 of this big book, and I have found myself generally in about every page of this book, one time or another, and on page 18 of this book, it tells my whole story in a couple little paragraphs, and I'll read them to you. And it says, an illness of this sort, we've come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, we're all sorry for him, and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents, and anyone can increase the list. And it's been said many times here this weekend that alcoholism is a family illness. And if you live with one of us very long, you're going to be affected by it. That's why we have Al-Anon, thank God. Check it out if you haven't. It's a good program. And, you know, our book said that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Spiritual, not only, to me, not only means my relationship with God, it means my own moral fiber. And my fiber, moral fiber, was affected when I was about 6, 7 years old. Because, you know, I look back today and I can see that my dad was an alcoholic. He had an obsession to drink. And my mother had an obsession to see that he didn't drink. And I grew up in that. And they fought and they fussed and they raised hell with each other and all those sort of things. And I was affected by it emotionally as a young child. Used to bite my fingernails clear down to the quick because I was so nervous from all that fighting and fussing. And I was affected by it. My dad's drinking got worse, and we know that alcoholism is a progressive illness, a malady. And his progressively got worse, and she progressively got worse, and I grew up in that. And my dad's drinking became so bad that he began to threaten my mother with guns and knives and stuff. And sometimes he'd pull out a knife and threaten to kill her there at the breakfast table or something. And then other times he would take her out for the weekend and tell his kids, I'm going to kill your mom this weekend. And they'd be gone all weekend. And I'm sitting at home wondering, are they going to do that this time? Is he going to do that? And I'm just a little kid, and I was affected by it emotionally. Well, eventually my mother had to have him arrested and put in the Eastern State Hospital in Bonita, which is our local nut house. They didn't have any alcoholic treatment facilities in those days. What they had was a criminally insane ward. And as a little child, I used to hitchhike up there, my brother and I, and go back into Building 3 and see my father and take him a couple of dollars and a carton of cigarettes from time to time. And I saw things back there that you're not supposed to see. Nobody's supposed to see what goes on back there, but I saw them, the little child, and I was affected by them. And I began to get a lot of ideas, emotions, and attitudes, Dr. Jung told Roland, which become the guiding force of my life. And I identified with Sterling last night in that respect. Because one thought came to me as I was hitchhiking home from up there was this. And as I said, if God, you got to blame it on somebody, right, when you're 7, 8 years old. If God is going to do this to me and to us, then to hell with God, I'll never be asking him for anything. And if I ever get big enough they can't catch me, I'm not going either to church. My mother lived her whole life in church and going to church and practicing her religion. And she tried to put that up to influence me in that, but I rejected it. And I blamed it on God because I didn't have anybody else to blame it on. And one time coming back from up there, I had a feeling within me. And I said, man, if it hurts like this to love people, I'm going to quit loving people. It hurts too bad. And so I began to push people out of my life. And another thought came to me was, if anything good is going to happen in my life, it's going to happen because I, all alone, without any help, made it that way. So I was totally self-sufficient. Didn't need nothing. Didn't need God. Didn't need nothing. Didn't need anybody. And I lived my life that way. So when I arrived at Alcoholics Anonymous, I had the coping skills of a 7 or 8 year old boy, which wasn't much. I had the spiritual knowledge of a 7 or 8 year old boy, which wasn't much. I had the sexual knowledge of a 11 or 12 year old boy that I learned off the streets. I remember one time going to my mom, and I said, Mom, I've been thinking about sex, and scared the heck out of her. She said, oh, my God, Benny Joe, that's my name. She said, oh, my God, Benny Joe, that's not a good thing to think about. It's a dirty, filthy, rotten thing to think about, she said, and you ought to save it for the one you love. And besides that, she said, the only reason you want to have sex is to have children. And I figured right quick, well, she had 5 children, 5 times. And no wonder my dad was in the nut house, I thought, you know. But somehow I didn't believe that. And so I went to the only source of information that was available to me. And in West Tulsa, Oklahoma, in front of the Jenkins Cafe, was a bunch of wise, intelligent, experienced men and women of about 15 or 16 years old. And they told me all I ever wanted to know about it. I mean, they were more than happy to share with me everything they knew. And some of those things those guys were doing it with these girls at night, sometimes 3 or 4 women a night. Sometimes 10 or 12 times a night, they said. And my eyes got that big around, you see. And the fallacy of all that is, I was sober 2 or 3 years before I figured out they were lying to me. At least I hope they were lying to me. So you see, I had the sexual knowledge of a 12 or 13-year-old boy that I learned off the streets from people that didn't know any more about it than I did. In fact, they were ignorant. They were just like me. Sometime in AA, you hear them talk about denial. I was never into denial. Man, I've been into ignorant all my life. I just didn't know that I didn't know. Thank God I've had the kind of people I've had in AA to teach me the right things to do and think and be. Thank God I have had the best in AA. I've had the very best. Well, my life started out, and eventually I got married. And I dated this little gal, and she had 2 little boys, and I was just 17, 18 years old, and out, fresh out of the Army. Been in the Army and out by that time. And we drank and did all the things people do when they drink, and eventually we got married and did all right for a couple of years, but my money wasn't accumulating like I'd hoped it would. And so I started hanging around the bars down there where they talked in thousands. They chattered in millions and talked in thousands. Nobody had any money, but they talked a lot about it. Man, I liked that. Fell right in with that group. And I'd go down there after work and have a few drinks, and next thing I know, it's 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. And I'd go home, and my wife would be so upset. She'd be just like my mother, raising hell with me. And I'm out there trying to hustle up a living, I told her. She didn't quite believe all that. And sometimes I'd come home, she'd have all my stuff thrown out in the yard. Y'all know what I mean by stuff? Dirty t-shirts and dirty shorts and things that needed ironing. They never throw out anything that's clean for some reason, I don't know. And then sometimes I'd come home, she'd have the door locked, and she'd file for divorce on me and put restraining orders on me. She did that 4 times. Make me so dang mad after all I'd done to her. I mean, after all I was done for her, she'd treat me like that. One time I threw a little sober spell and decided to try to get back home. I was serious. I wasn't fooling around. So I went to her preacher, the church that she went to, and I went in and sat down and talked to him. And he looked at me and said, "Well, Joe, what seems to be your problem?" "Well, I don't know what my problem is, really. I mean, I really don't know. If I'd have known, I'd have told him. But I told him what I thought it was, and it was her. If you live with her, you'd drink too," I said. And I believe that's true. And he gave me a solution, and they will give you a solution if you talk to one of them. And he said, "You must," and boy, did he emphasize that word, "must. You must have faith in these things," and you know what he told me. And I just looked at him. I could not have faith in the things that he told me. You know why? Because I didn't even believe them. How can you have faith in something that you don't even believe? So I got up and I walked out of there and continued to have trouble. Eventually we were divorced for sure the last time, and this time I let it become permanent. And I was sitting out the Zebra Lounge one night. Beautiful place. Y'all know it. And I got to thinking there one night. Y'all, either this, you guys that are new, either drink or think. But don't get the two of them mixed up. And I was sitting there drinking, and I got to thinking. I think I'll go over and visit. Anybody know what I mean by visit? Okay. I'm going to go over and visit. And I knew she'd be lonely. Hadn't seen me in about 3 or 4 months. And, well, wouldn't you be if you hadn't seen me? So I went over there and I knocked on the door, and she kind of peeked. I just broke right in there is what I did. And I got in my house, and there was a big old boy bigger than me sitting in my recliner watching my TV in my house with my wife, and I'm making payments on all that. Well, what are you going to do? I did. And that boy liked to beat me to death on my own living room floor. Put me out in the yard and told me not to ever come back. Man, I lived on that one for a long time. Ooh. I'd run that around in my head before I got sober 10,000 times, if y'all know what I mean. And then later on, I'm still drinking, and I'm drinking now for another reason. I used to drink. This was a alcoholism, a progressive illness. And I started drinking and a lot, I mean a lot. And one night I was sitting in the bar, like this, and Phyllis came in, my current wife. I call her my current wife, just keep her on her toes. Stand up there, Phyllis, and take a look. Phyllis was long and tall, and she was the queen bee of the Zebra Lounge. The queen bee of the Z. And boy, she was pretty, and it still is pretty, and we were introduced, and she looked at me and said, "You know, Joe, you look like my third husband." I said, "My God, how many have you had?" And she said, "Two." Well, I liked that right away. Phyllis and I started dating and doing all the things that we do when we're dating, except for one thing. I wasn't interested in sex. I guarantee you one thing, when you'd rather drink than have sex, you're sick. And I was that way. I was just too much damn trouble. You get that way. And after a few months, or several months, we got married. A couple of months later, her daughter came to live with us. And she said, "Joe, we're drinking too much, and Gail wants to come live with us, and we need to quit drinking and let the girl come and live with us, make a home." And I thought, that's a good idea. I wanted to do that. She was about 10 years old at the time. And she came, and Phyllis and I stayed sober about 30 days. I say 30 days. She said about 2 weeks. But this is the first time I realized I can't quit drinking. I mean, really. I went in about 2 weeks of that, and my head felt like somebody had it in a clamp, and every day it was going to turn it down just one more notch. And I felt the top of my head was going to come off. And finally, I stopped at the liquor store one day and bought a couple of pints of whiskey and drank one of them before I got home, which was 2.5 blocks. And shared one with Phyllis. She'd been sober that length of time, too, and she needed a drink. And we was off and running again. And Phyllis and I got where we couldn't drink together. Every time we'd take a drink, we'd fight. I mean, every time. Every time we'd go out to the bar before the second beer was over, we'd be fussing and fighting. And we just couldn't go together. So we kind of made a deal. We split up Tulsa. About 41st Street and South was hers, and 41st Street and North was mine. And I don't bother her, she don't bother me, and from time to time we'd meet at our house and visit, and that was our deal. Well, on my side of town, out to the west, is a lake, Lake Keystone, and I bought a mobile home out there. And it was nice. I had it fixed up real nice. I didn't think she knew anything about it. I didn't think she even knew I was gone. But I'm out there one night, and there's a, was a bit louder than that, knock on the door, screaming and hollering out there, and finally I got up and looked out, and there was Phyllis and little daughter Gail, and they just kind of broke in is what they did. Embarrassed me in front of my girlfriend. I was not having a good time. And the next morning I got up and all my stuff was laying out in the yard like it's supposed to be. Filed for divorce, restraining order, went to the bank and made off with what little money we had after all I'd done to her. I mean, after all I'd done for her, treat me like that. Well, I said to myself, well, the hell with her and the rest of them. I don't need them anyhow. And I'm going to drink when I want to drink, as often as I want to drink, and I don't care who knows it. And that's the day that I made a decision that I'm not going to try to control my drinking no more. No more control. I'm going to drink when I want to drink, as often as I want to drink, wherever I want to drink. No control on me whatsoever. If you didn't like it, you could hit it. That's the way I felt about it. Anyhow, one night I'm laying there in bed, and I look up, and a big rat jumped out of the ceiling right on my bed. Not that long. Fangs hanging down. And I kicked that sucker for, seemed like 30 minutes before I get him off the bed, and another one jumped down. And a little bit later, I went to town, got some big rat traps. I'm talking about some big ones, that wide. Sat around. It's a wonder I haven't broke my leg stomping around in that house in big rat trap. And I sold that place for half of what I'd paid for it to get rid of it, full of rats. And I moved to town. And, oh, by the way, if you're over to an A&A meeting and you see somebody coming in that's new and they're seeing things or hearing things that you don't see or hear, go along with them, will you? because they're definitely seeing and hearing those things, and I know about that. But anyhow, I moved into town there, and I started drinking really hard. I bought Canadian Club by the case, and I drank a lot of whiskey. And finally, one Saturday was a typical day in my life, and a typical Saturday in my life. I kind of woke up, had four or five drinks and two or three cigarettes, and I went back to sleep. Like blacking out is what I was doing, but I call it going back to sleep. And I did that about two or three times that day, and finally that evening late I got up and had four or five drinks and two or three cigarettes and started about the little bars that I had frequented and ended up in a place on West Tulsa called the Misty Dawn. And boy, it was a lovely place. Almost smell it now. And I've been drinking hard all that day, and I was sitting on the bar stool that night about midnight. And I had a sick feeling within my stomach. It wasn't a throwing up sick, it was a sick feeling. It felt like the whole inside of me was going to drop out, you know. And I got up off that bar stool and went out and laid down in my car a little while, and I drove back to my little apartment I was staying in, and I got on the couch while I was sleeping. I had a nice new bedroom back there, new bed, new mattress. I didn't have any pillows or sheets or anything. I was too busy. You know, you get busy when you're drinking. I was too busy to go to the store and buy those things, so I slept on the couch. The truth of the matter is I slept on the couch because that's where the television was and the radio was and the lamp was, and I was scared to death and didn't even know it. And that's why I slept. Well, that next morning I woke up, and I'm sitting there, and I'm reliving my life again for the 10,000th time, trying to figure out what in the world happened to me. How did I end up in this situation? Never intended to be like this. And I did two things that morning that I hadn't done in a long, long time. And one of them was that I got on my knees beside that couch and I asked God to help me to find a way to stay sober and to get my life straightened out. I hadn't asked God for nothing in a long time. I didn't do that. Another thought came to me after about an hour, so I don't know if God's going to help me any. And I don't blame him. So I called my friend George Gibbs, a little black guy that I met going in the Army. He died last year. He was my good friend. We never had a harsh word between us ever, thanks to him. And George was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called him. I said, George, are you still going to Alcoholics Anonymous? He said he was. And I said, George, I need help. See, that's the second thing I did that morning. I asked another human being for help. And George came over to my house, my little apartment, and he stayed with me for the next 3 days, sobering me up, because I was sick. I mean, I was really sick. And I've had the best that Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer, and that's it. I weighed 135 pounds. I eat a bologna sandwich once in a while because I knew you were supposed to eat. Didn't want it. I drank. And I started getting sober, and I was sick. And he wiping the sweat off my brow and the puke off of my mouth and just being with me. Did that for 3 days. And on the third day, on Tuesday night, November the 3rd, 1973, he took me to my very first AA meeting. And I sat there in that meeting, and get this, 3 days not drinking, sick. And I began to look around the rooms, and I said to myself, what's a nice guy like me doing in a place like this with people like you? Hell, I don't even drink with people like you. You see, that old attitude that I don't need God, nothing, or nobody began to come back after 3 days. Just 3 days. That's why I need the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship. Went to a little conference down in Apache, Oklahoma. I met a lady there. Her name was Alabama Carruthers. My first conference was here at Captain Shreve, Tri-State Roundup. Captain Shreve in Shreveport. Bells and I went down there. A little bit later, I was to go down to Apache, Oklahoma. I met this lady named Alabama Carruthers, and she talked that night. She said two things that really helped me. One of them, she said she had a soul sickness. I said, yeah, that's what that was. Sitting on that bar stool, a soul sickness. Finally found a word that could put to the feeling. Soul sickness. That's what it was. And she said she had peace of mind tonight. And I said, my God, I've never had peace of mind. Never. Since a little old kid, never had been peace of mind. I wanted to talk to her. And and after the meeting was over, we were sitting around this old hotel, and I said, Alabama, it's about 3 o'clock in the morning. Georgia laying over in her lap asleep. You get that picture. Alabama, Carruthers, and George. And I said, Alabama, you said you had peace of mind tonight. How did you get peace of mind? And she said, well, Joe, tell me what's going on in your mind. So I told her about these two incidences and how my mind would race uncontrollably day after day after day after day after night after night after night. And the only way I could stop my mind from turning was to take a drink. The only way. And drink for oblivion. And there's only one thing wrong with oblivion, though, isn't it? As you wake up and you got to drink again. And that's the way that went. And she said, well, Joe, you're just full of resentments. And I said, well, what is a resentment? She said, a resentment's old angers and old hurts that are refelt over and over and over. And all that anger you intend to use upon those other people, you're turning it on yourself. You're making yourself sick and you're blaming it on them. It's all their fault. And I had to get her to explain that to me because I knew it was their fault. It was always their fault. And today I realize it was my fault, you see. I mean, I think today, thank God I know it's my fault. What if it was their fault? Not a thing in the world you could do about it. But I could find a solution for this. And I said, well, Alabama, is there any solution for that? And she said, yes, there is. And Alabama looked down in that purse of hers and dug around, you know how they do, and dug around down in there for a while, and she came out with this big book. And she said, Joe, on page 551 of this book is an experience of a lady who had a lot of resentments. And she said, if you'll do what she did, chances are it'll help you. She said it helped her, maybe it helped me. So she let me read that. And I'll just read the portion over here on page 552. And he said, in effect, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you will pray for the person thing you resent, you will be free. If you ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you really don't want it for them and your prayers are only words you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks and you'll find you've come to mean it and want it for them. And you'll realize where you used to feel bitterness, resentment, and hatred, you now feel compassion, understanding, and love. Well, I went home after that meeting and got in bed. My mind started racing again. And I said, I think I'll pray for those people. And I prayed for them. Next morning, I woke up myself. I think I'll pray for those people. And I began to pray for them and add some names to the list. As the days went by, my list got longer and longer, and I prayed constantly. It seemed like I was in constant prayer. And one day in the spring, I was driving down the Lewis Street, 31st and Lewis area, beautiful, beautiful area in our town, and I got stuck in the stoplight, just the length of the stoplight. One of those beautiful mornings like it is this morning. It was kind of cool, and I looked over there, and those tulips were in full bloom, red and yellow. The grass was green. The little squirrels were jumping around the trees. The birds were singing. And the thought came to me, oh, my God, it's a beautiful morning. It's a beautiful morning. How long has it been since I've seen these kinds of things? And you know what? I couldn't remember. I don't know until that moment if I'd ever seen those things before. When this book talks about being cut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, I know what that means. I mean, I really do know what that means. And that's the morning I knew this program would work for me. I took some action and I got some results. And then I began to have trouble with this God idea. After these miracles, and then I got to have trouble. I'd messed up. And George said, you're having trouble with this God idea, aren't you? I said, George, I'm having a terrible, terrible time with this. And he said, well, let's go to page 46 of this book. And there's a little deal in there that said it helped him. Maybe it helped me. I said, help me understand. You know, it said over there that you have a God of your own understanding. And my understanding, really, was one was going to get me. And I believe that today, if God was going to get anybody, he had got me. But he didn't get me. And on page 46, he said, yes, we of agnostic temper have had these thoughts and experiences. Gnostic means knowledge, and you put the ag in front of it, means without. Those of us who are without knowledge. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even the willingness to believe in the power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. He said, in other words, Joe, why don't you go home tonight? But try to lay up all that stuff you think you know about God. Get you a pencil and piece of paper out. And if you could make God, realizing that you can't, but if you could, what would you want God to be? And I went home that night and I wrote down some things that I would like God to be if I could make God. And I showed them to George and he said, that's good. You can start with that. See, I didn't know you could do that. Man, I didn't know you. You go to hell out in Oklahoma for doing that. Don't know about down here in Louisiana, but out there in Oklahoma, you go to hell for doing that. And he gave me permission. And I needed permission to start at that simple, simple level. I needed that permission. The preacher said, you must have faith. And I couldn't have any faith because I didn't even believe. So I had to come to believe. Thank God for the second step. Well, I could come to believe through that simple little process. And our book said, much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. I tried to believe as they believed. I could not believe as they believed. I had to have my own understanding. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and effective contact with Him. My own conception. And today, I look back, I know why that works so well. You know why it works so well? Have you ever had any problem with your own conception of anything? I haven't. If it's my idea, it's good. Great. So I had my own conception. And that was a good. And I said, George, you mean I got to find God? And he said, Joe, God's not lost. He said, it's not in the finding anyhow, it's in the seeking. And he went on to read, we found that God does not make too hard a work with those who seek Him. Not find, but to seek. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men. See, it's not in the finding, it's in the seeking. And if I will seek God into my life, question and wonder and look for God into my life, that He will disclose Himself to me, which is exactly what has happened to me. And I know in the steps today that I was powerless over alcohol. You can boil that down to one word, powerless. And if I am powerless, then I need power, obviously. Well, where am I to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Where and how to find the power. And I looked all over. I looked all over. One time I was taking this young fella who was living in a halfway house. He asked me to be his sponsor. I'm taking him back and forth to work to get a paycheck. And he told me a story one day on the way to work and went like this. He said, these three wise men from the East, the way he put it, they stole from man the crown of life and woman. And they said, now that we took it away from them, the thing that would make them the happiest, what are we going to do with it? And I said, one of them said, let's take it to the highest, highest mountain on the face of the ocean and hide it in the highest crevice, and they'll never find it there. But the other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt and search till they eventually find it. The second one said, let's take it to the deepest ocean and hide it in the deepest crevice in the ocean, and they'll never find it there. The other two said, yeah, but you know how they are. They'll hunt and they'll search, and they'll eventually find it. The third one said, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's hide it within Himself. And he'll never think about looking for her there, ever. And certainly I didn't. On page 55, he says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. See, we're just born with it. Just there. You can't deny it. It's just there. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship, by other things, but in some form or other, it's there. For faith and power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. See, it's just been there always, as much as I tried to deny it. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but He was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, is only there that it may be found. Deep down inside of every man, woman, and child, including me, is the fundamental idea of God. Now, if you don't believe that, you go downtown here and you find the highest building that you can find. if you're agnostic or atheist, and you jump off. And I guarantee you one thing, before you hit bottom, you'll holler, "Oh God." Because it's just there. Just deep down inside of us, it's just there. As much as I tried to deny it. And our book says we can only clear the ground a bit. If our testimony helps sweep away prejudice, and by the way, prejudice means old ideas, which is what I had a lot of, enables you to think honestly, encourages you to search diligently within yourself, then if you wish, you can join us on the broad highway. With this attitude, you cannot fail. Now get this next. The consciousness of your belief is sure to come to you. You'll have a God of your own understanding that nobody but nobody could improve upon. Nobody. Not even the Pope. Because you'll have a God of your own understanding. And that's what this chapter, We Agnostic, is all about. I love all these chapters, but this one especially. Because I'm just supposed to read this chapter and question and to wonder what it means to me. And what it does, and this chapter is not here to tell us about any particular type of religion at all. It's simply here to open up my mind with an open mind that God might teach to me that there's a God. The consciousness of my belief is sure to come to me. And what a promise that is, and that's exactly what has happened in my life. So I went on about my business there. Page 62, I'm getting ready to make a decision to turn my will and my life over the care of God. I knew that. I could see what we're coming to. And, you know, it took the doctor's opinion, the first four chapters, to do steps 1 and 2. There's no way to work steps 1 and 2 out of the big book. They're conclusions that we get based upon the information that we have. And I was so glad to hear Sterling mention the doctor's opinion, the malady of alcoholism. See, I didn't know what my problem was. I was sober and ate too long before I read the doctor's opinion and had explained to me. And I was at a place here a few years ago and speaking one time and mentioned the doctor's opinion, and there was an old fellow come up, even them old-timers in AA, which I love, who are guardians of the fellowship through the traditions. And I was standing there, and he come up to me and said, "What book were you reading?" He jumped at me. I didn't even know the man. And I said, "Well, I was reading the doctor's opinion." He said, "What book did you get it out of?" I said, "I got it out of this big book." I had a little softback version of the big book. He said, "Show that to me." And I showed it to him. He turned around and left. The next day he came up, and before he got to me, he started crying. I said, "What's the matter?" He said, "Joe, I've been a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous for 39 years, and I didn't know the doctor's opinion was in that book." You know, we can stay in AA and be into ignorance for 39 years. And he said, "I'm going to tell you one thing." He said, "I get back to my home, I'm going to start a big book study in my home, and we're going to look into this book and see what's in there." Called me 6 months later, said, "I'm having a wonderful time doing this thing." But I almost missed this part of the book. He said, "Because of being selfish and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles," and that was my problem. "Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of the fellows and they retaliate. When you don't need God, nothing, or nobody, you have to depend on yourself." And I depended on myself, and I didn't need God, nothing, or nobody. Self-sufficient to the extreme. He said, "But we find that sometime in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later puts us in a position to be hurt." I made decisions based upon what I wanted, which later put me in a position to be hurt. So our troubles were basically of my own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually didn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. There's no must in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody can tell anybody else what they must do, but there's a lot of must in this book. And there's a couple of them right there. We must do it, kills us, and God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we ever liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing and trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. I see many people like me who was trying to make myself well through my own thinking. My best thinking got me here. You know, I must have God's help. And I could remember back when I was drinking. At time from time, I was going to quit drinking. I was going to control and enjoy. I've heard that a couple of times. That's two different things, by the way. Control and enjoy. If I had to control my drinking, it wasn't much fun. I didn't enjoy it at all. Now, if I enjoyed my drinking, I didn't control it. So I couldn't control and enjoy my drinking. I couldn't do it. So from time to time, I'd quit drinking. And I pulled out the most useful tool at my disposal at that time was my own willpower. And I got lots of willpower. Phil said, I never have used much of it, but I got a lot of it. And I'd pull out that willpower and I'd say, sick 'em, Will, we're through with this drinking. I'm never going to drink again as long as I live. And I didn't for 2 weeks at one time. So I found my willpower doesn't work. And then I began to wonder, am I just crazy? Is that the problem? So if your willpower don't work, you begin to question your sanity. At least that's what I did. You know, and if your sanity, you question your sanity, you see, it don't work because of the obsession of the mind. And the obsession of the mind is an idea that overpowers all other ideas. In other words, it is stronger than my willpower. And if you want to know why your willpower don't work, it's because the obsession of the mind is stronger than the will. Now, there's only one thing stronger than the will, or the obsession of the mind. Only one. And that's God who made it. The only one. See, I come to know that. And I come to see that I'm going to have to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over the care and direction of God. Because if I could have done it, I'd have done it. I couldn't do it. And he said, this is the how and why of it. First of all, there's lots of instructions in this book. Here's one. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. See, I was playing God in my life, Phyllis's life, and anybody else's life that would let me. Now, she never did let me. And one thing I know about self is we all got one. That's the problem with it. And my will for Phyllis is one thing, and her will for Phyllis is another. And a lot of times they don't jive together. He said, I had to quit playing God in her life and my life and everybody else's and leave people alone. It didn't work. And it says next instruction. Next, we decided that hereafter in this realm of life, God was going to be our director. Let God direct my life. He's the principal, we're his agents. He's the father and we're his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch, which was the path to freedom. And what was that? He's the principal, we're the agent. He's the father, we're the children. Most good ideas are simple. And I almost missed that. See, I almost missed that. When I used to pray sometimes when I was young and sobriety, I said, God, give me this, and God, give me that, and God, get my wife back, and God, help me make more money. And God, I used God like an errand boy, sending him out to get things for me, see. And after I got sober for a while, I began to read that other big book, and it said in the front of that book that he worked for 6 days, and then he rested. And to my knowledge, he never go back to work anymore. It looks to me like there will be work being done around here. It's going to be me. He's the father. We're the children. He's the principal. We're the agent. Most good ideas are simple. And I almost missed that. Top of page 63, it said, when we sincerely took such a position, he's the father, we're the children, we're the agent, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. See, I'm supposed to perform his work well. You see, I didn't know that. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves and our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. See, I'd always been a taker. Takers are losers, man. I mean, takers are losers in life. Not just in AA, but life. I've come to know that. Takers, I'm always a taker. See? Now I see what I can contribute to my AA meetings and to life in general. As we felt that new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter we were reborn. Somebody talked about being reborn. I think it was Don. Happened just like that. And I used to hate that idea about being reborn when I was drinking. They used to come over to my house and got church up the road, and they want to talk to me about being reborn Monday night. And they come in and say, boy, this is Monday night football. And you're here giving me that crap. And I run them out. Down the street, get out of here. I'm going to talk to you. So I didn't like that idea about being reborn. And when I got sober and I read another book, there was a fellow in there, his name, he was just like me, his name was Nicodemus, dumber than a rock, didn't know nothing. And he asked that fellow who was talking about being reborn, he said, you mean I got to go back into my mother's womb and be reborn? And he looked at him like, I'm sure Franklin has looked at me a dozen of times, shook his head. He said, boy, don't you know when I, did you go to university? Aren't you educated? Don't you know you can't go back into your mother's womb and be reborn? When I'm talking to you about being reborn, I'm talking about the renewing of your mind. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which used to be the guiding force of the lives of these people, are suddenly cast to one side. We're being reborn, not in our bodies, but in our mind. That's what we're doing here in this book. Someone told me one time, said, Joe, you're being brainwashed by that AA. And I said, man, my brain needed washing. You know? I didn't know that I didn't know that I didn't know that I didn't know that I didn't know. I was stupid. I know I wasn't stupid. I was ignorant. Be stupid means you can't learn. Ignorant means you're uninformed, and I was just uninformed. Well, now I can see what they meant by this third step prayer. And I knew what they were doing on Sunday morning out that little church. They're doing it every Sunday morning, as far as I know, about 11 o'clock. And I couldn't wait until Sunday morning to get down there to do the third step prayer. And I got there about 2 or 3 minutes before 11. I really didn't want to get there too early. I might hear something to help me, you know. So about 2 or 3 minutes before 11, I walked in the back of that church and stood in the back of the room. And sure enough, that preacher asked people to come down there and basically to do the third step prayer. That's what he was asking us to do. And I went down there as humbly and as honestly and as sincerely as I have ever done anything in my life. And I went down there, and this is what I said. I said, God, I offer myself to you to deal with me and do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do your will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those that I would help of your power, your love, and your way of life. May I do your will always. I don't know what happened that morning. I'm not smart enough to know. But I do know this. From that day until this day, my life hasn't been the same. Just has not been the same. That afternoon, I went to see my mother. She said, Benny Joe, you're different. What you doing different? And I said, I've been going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know that. She said, yeah, but you're different. What happened? I said, well, I went to church this morning. I did this third step prayer, and I explained it to her. And she smiled. She was happy about that. Later on, I went over to see Phyllis. And if she was telling this story, she'd say that I was her Ebby. She said there was something about my eyes that was different. She wanted to know why. She said, what happened? And I don't know. There's another story in another big, big book. This guy, he was blind, and all of a sudden he could see. And they said, what happened to you? And he said, I don't know. I was blind, but now I can see. I was blind, and now I can see. Phyllis and I started seeing each other after that. And 2.5 years later, she got sober. Took a while. And we slowly started putting our life back together, one day at a time. And if you want to talk about it, we've done it. We've experienced it, one day at a time. And she got sober, and we got actively involved in AA, had been. I became a delegate. Phyllis became a delegate. Life was good. Our little daughter, Gail, who was there that night and saw me in that situation, which just practically killed me. I mean, I couldn't stand it. Couldn't stand it. The guilt, shame, and remorse of it. And some 15 years later. See, a book says a few casual apologies are not enough. Got to live sober and live right. And we were there. For every one of her children we were born, we were there, sober and doing the right thing. And she moved off to Ohio. And I didn't mind her moving and Jim, but they took my grandkids with them. And we talked to them all the time. And finally, something happened to one of her sister-in-law. She died, her same age. She died unexpectedly and left a couple of kids with their daddy. And they called us one night. And she said, if something happens to the kids with you, Mom, take them. I said, yeah. That's when I knew it was all right with us. So our lives had been put back together there until about a year ago. I could say my grandkids have escaped the illness of alcoholism. I could say that, and it was true until my 18-year-old daughter, granddaughter, graduated from high school. Man, the next week she went crazier than a peach orchard boar. I don't know what happened. She hadn't straightened out yet. She graduated from high school. She was raised in church through her parents. Every time the door was open, they were there, involved in all kinds of activities. She graduated from high school, and next week she was shacked up with an old boy and drinking and doing those things. And she hadn't got over that yet. I hope someday she will, for her sake, because I know the road. So things are good. Things are good. Phyllis worked in the central office for a number of years in Tulsa, and we stayed busy, and she retired about 2 years ago, and I sold her business a couple of years ago, and we've been traveling together, going here and going there, doing things, loving Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, I don't have time to work anymore. I just don't have time for it, because I love doing what I'm doing, and we've been all over the country. I was fortunate that when I was sober, early 1974, I met Charlie and Joe McQueenie. I was one of their first students. There was Tony, the Mexican, and then there was me. And Tony invited me to go in the room with him, and I made a right-hand turn, went in there, and changed my life. I've become a student of this book. I've been reading and studying this book ever since. In our group, that's what we do as a group. We read and study this book, and we share what's going on in this book. And Charlie asked me in 1990 if I'd go with him and help him, because Joe was doing some things that he couldn't get away all the time. And I said to myself, oh, heck, or words to that effect. And I said, okay, I'll go, because I've been taught not to turn down an AA request. And I've been going ever since. And boy, the big book has come alive for me now. I can really see a lot of things in this book that I couldn't even see before. There's no end to this book. And I said, how come that it is, Franklin? He said, there's no end to this book because there's no end to God. And this book was written by God through Bill's hand. And I believe that to be true today. And every time I read this book, it's different than what it was the last time I read it. You know why that's true? Because I'm different. I'm growing in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love AA. I'm one of those people who guard the fellowship with the truth of traditions today. And I said what I do. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. See, I know today unless you love AA, you can't stay sober. And if you don't respect AA, you can't love it. You can't love your kids unless you respect them. You see? We got traditions. Respect AA through the traditions. You see? That's as simple as I know how to put it. You know? And I look at all those things. And you know, by the way, I learned one thing this weekend from the speakers. And when they do that, you know what that means? Nothing. It just gives you a sense that he's going to shut up pretty soon. And I'm going to shut up pretty soon. But I know the steps or the actions we take These are the actions we take. And I know the traditions are the non-actions that we do, the things we don't do. And I know that the concepts of how we interact, the service committees interact with each other. Total program. Action, non-action, interaction. And I see the whole picture. I've experienced it, thank God. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And let's keep it just the way it is. It's working just fine. It's working just fine. And I thank you all for having us here this weekend. It's been a wonderful time. Great, great people, great food, great everything. And I feel good about it. Thank you.
Hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.